From the independent producer project of KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters.
My first grade teacher let me sit in the back of the room while she read aloud to the rest of the class. I'd write stories back there. I wrote my stories on brightly colored construction paper with crayon and pencil. They revolved around little girls playing with foxes. I remember drinking in my teacher's praises once reading time was over. She would say things like, "Such imagination! You're so talented!" And after school, my parents would read my story booklets and beam at me. "You are such a great writer! So smart!" 6 years old, and I already knew I was destined. I remember when my family bought our first desktop computer in 1999, a beige Compaq with a monitor the size of a toaster oven. I begged my mom for one of her floppy disks, insisting that I needed to start my writing career. She gave me a purple one, and I started work on my masterpieces. By that point, I moved on from foxes. Now my stories were fabricated diaries set in the American frontier. They were rife with the kinds of misunderstandings that only a 9-year-old could be forgiven for. And all the while, my parents doted on me. "Bethany's a little writer. She'll publish her first book before she's 20. To make matters worse, I believed I had a natural knack for voices and accents. And as a result, I joined the local children's theater. In third grade, during the production of A Gingerbread Christmas, Tyler McRae was cast for the lead unisex gingerbread child instead of me. I met with the music teacher after class in angry tears, and I demanded the part. "I can do it better. I can remember the words better than he can." My music teacher listened to my cries and nodded, and offered me a new role as a compromise. It was the part she originally cast herself in, the role of the narrator. I accepted her offer only because I knew that the narrator was really much more important than the lead unisex gingerbread child. I grew up in rural Montana, and I constantly fantasized about the big, wide world beyond. Bored with the tranquility that came from living in the country, I dreamed of the day when my talents would inevitably take me to live and work in a big city. I knew everything already, so I phoned it in through elementary and middle school. Like, I never read To Kill a Mockingbird. In fact, I frequently skipped the readings in school and just coasted on the fact that I could write a decent essay when push came to shove. My bad grades came from inept teachers, and my good grades came from those who saw my brilliance and creativity. I was too big for my pond, so I went looking for a way to prove it.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
an ocean full of beautiful, Prada-wearing rainbow trout.
The podcast about
the unknown.
In high school, I joined an elite team of nerds, the speech and debate team. Speech and debate is kind of like track and field. It's a series of competitive speaking events with winners and losers. High school students would dress up in ill-fitting suits and compete with other teenagers in formal debates or memorized public speeches. My school, Flathead High School in Kalispell, Montana, was the largest high school in the entire state, and our school had both a junior varsity and varsity teams, the latter of which was competitive and selective. Other schools would be lucky to have 20 kids on their speech and debate team, whereas we had well over 60. Our teams were stronger, more polished. I was only a sophomore when I moved from the JV to the varsity team. My specialty was serious oral interpretation. It's a monologue event. No props, no costumes, no gestures, just you dressed in your mom's best business suit with a binder, a timer, and 10 minutes to give a convincing performance to three glassy-eyed judges in a room full of other competitors. The real challenge was to find a monologue that contained the appropriate level of tragedy porn, but still felt new and fresh. Only an amateur would make the mistake of reading from something like The Crucible, a text that became so overdone and passé that its horror would be lost upon a room full of rolling eyes. In my junior year, I started traveling more for varsity events. Nearly every weekend, I rode with flocks of Flathead High School speech and debaters and yellow school buses. We bussed for hours and hours across the Big Sky Country as the sun set, arriving at hotels in quote-unquote big cities like Butte and Great Falls. I negotiated with my teammates both a shower schedule and an iron schedule. We gathered for continental breakfasts by 7 a.m., and when we arrived at the tournaments, our team would set up camp in the cafeteria, covering the floor with our bodies and backpacks. We were always the best. And when we won, I cried fierce tears of joy and felt euphoric. My teammates and I accepted our awards as if they were our birthright. I felt part of something big and important. It was my final year of high school, and I assumed my position with the other seniors at the top of the team. I felt entitled to victory and recognition. It was my chance to make a name for myself that the underclassmen would utter with reverence. I was on the cusp of adulthood, and soon I would leave my small town to follow my destiny. I felt as if I was at the lip of an abyss, ready to leap. As I prepared for my final season of serious oral interpretation, I knew I needed something absolutely gut-wrenching. To win, I needed some kind of severe tragedy monologue that warranted a truly emotional response. One day after school, I took myself to Borders Bookstore and I found the dramatic arts section. Within a few minutes, I stumbled upon a script called I Stand Before You Naked. It was a collection of monologues by Joyce Carol Oates. Her name sounded familiar enough. She was probably one of those authors whose work I'd pretended to read in class. I flipped through the pages until I found a title that looked enticing. Nuclear Holocaust. I skimmed the synopsis. It was the fictional ramblings of an unnamed woman in a mental institution. She was a Southerner, a Bible thumper, who tells the audience how she couldn't wait for Jesus to come back and annihilate all the sinners with a nuclear holocaust. The script also included directions for shouting and cackling. Bingo. There in the bookstore, I imagined performing the piece. I would hold my pauses uncomfortably long, staring madly at judges, opening my eyes as wide as I could and resisting the urge to blink until tears welled. Then I would scream, letting my spit fly. So I bought the book. I memorized Nuclear Holocaust and performed it many times for many judges in many high schools.
I am competitor number 4166, and will begin my monologue now. Jesus isn't angry because he brings us love, but there's plenty angry in his place. Praise Jesus! Yeah, your face shows how serious you're listening, but I know better. It's just your salary.
imminent nuclear holocaust became a character I could slip into and out of at will. My teammates congratulated me after strong performances, telling me, "You're scary good. You're going to win for sure." My high school graduation loomed nearer and nearer, and I felt an increasing pressure to leave my mark on my high school, to graduate a champion. That opportunity came in the form of the National Qualifiers Tournament for the entire state of Montana. The winners of this tournament would move on to the national competition, held annually in the faraway land of Las Vegas. I both dreaded and anticipated national qualifiers. It was my last opportunity to compete, and I hated the finality of it. This time, the tears wouldn't be fake. They were already there, just below the surface. I edged closer to the precipice.
Now I'm always praying for things to get right again. Y'all look at me here. And hear me talking, but in my heart I'm praying for the return of all sinners to God. Send the bomb to punish us at last in your mercy.
They held the awards ceremony on the high school's basketball court. They called me to the stage. I knew I did well, but I was still surprised when they called me forward as the winner. I won. I'm the best in the state. Again, the joyful tears came. So this is how it's gonna happen for me. I should have known. And so the weeks passed, and my senior year wrapped up. I shopped with my friends after school and worked as a grocery store cashier at Albertsons. I made little movies with school camcorders, and I smoked clove cigarettes at the shores of Flathead Lake. I went to prom with my dream date. I skipped class and took my final exams. I basked in the scary weirdness of being a senior in high school, knowing I was about to embark on the next big thing. Teetering on the brink of adulthood, everything felt important, every outing and memory significant in its tentative finality. I looked forward to Las Vegas, where I imagined winning first prize again, taking a victory lap around the stage, flying home in euphoria to the arms of my adoring friends, then whisking off in a breeze to college, triumphant that I was still on a path to fame and fortune. And all of this is a roundabout way of saying that I didn't practice my piece at all before going to Las Vegas that summer. Not once. I should have had my script memorized weeks before competing, but I knew I'd be fine. I was brilliant, this was my destiny, nuclear holocaust, yada yada yada. My mom, my stepdad, my grandma, and my aunt all traveled to Las Vegas too. It was a big deal for them. We left the mountains of northwestern Montana and traveled 4 hours downhill through Idaho and into Washington. We flew from the Spokane airport directly to Las Vegas. I ordered a Caesar salad at a place called the Rainforest Cafe. Caesar salad felt like something that a sophisticated person would eat on the night before a life-changing event. The next morning, I arrived at a high school that looked like a hotel. The hallways were outside the building, and palm trees grew in the courtyard. It was July, and I had never felt such heat so early in the morning. Inside the chilled cafeteria, we looked for spaces among the crowded tables. "Well, isn't this something?" my grandma said. She's not much taller than my shoulders and had on shorts, a t-shirt with a teddy bear, and a visor. I looked around and felt uneasy as I noticed a stark contrast between myself and the other competitors. Where I had my family of self-described country bumpkins, others had their private acting coaches. And these performers looked incredible, dressed in Prada and acting with the talent of full-fledged adults. I wore a pink pinstripe suit with a rip in the lining. I had two-toned hair and sweaty armpits. I felt a wave of panic come across me as I picked out snippets of conversation laden with real Southern accents from real Southerners. I immediately realized that my attempt to imitate them could only be heard as mockery. Suddenly, whatever level of self-confidence I'd spent the last 17 years cultivating left me, and through the panic came an overwhelming feeling of shame. I was ashamed at being the best serious oral interpreter in all of Montana, a prize that doesn't actually mean shit in the real world. My mom said, "Bethy, this is so cool. I'm so proud of you." And my grandma chimed in, "We all are, sweet girl." I was an imposter. I wasn't an actress. I didn't have a personal acting coach or a designer suit. I joined speech and debate for the affirmation, not because I had any convictions. And To Kill a Mockingbird had been too boring, so I had never finished it. I didn't belong here. We made our way to the outdoor hallway, leading to the room where I would recite the words of Nuclear Holocaust for the very last time. "You're from Montana?" The question came from a girl in the hallway standing next to us. "Yeah, you?" "Wyoming." She wore gray slacks with a white button-up shirt, an ensemble that seemed drab in a sea of sharp blacks and rich neutrals. She was standing alone, one earbud in her ear while clutching her binder. We shared a nervous laugh and recognized in each other the same nervous look of being completely out of our leagues. In our rural ponds, we were the big, exceptionally talented fish with destinies. But out here in the outdoor hallway of this high school that looked like a hotel, we were just the dumpiest fish in an ocean full of beautiful, Prada-wearing rainbow trout. We entered the room with my family in tow. At this point, I didn't care anymore. We sat near the back corner, and I silently berated myself once again for not practicing for months before today. The first competitor took the stage in the front of the room. She performed a monologue about a girl who'd escaped a concentration camp and fled to America. "Typical," I thought callously. But my smugness was short-lived because this girl was actually incredible. She embodied her role with the ease of a movie actress. She finished her monologue, and I noticed my mom and grandma quietly dabbing tears from their eyes. Shit. One after another, the performers were amazing. I watched the clock and vibrated my heel as if my life depended on it. My palms sweated as I tried to concentrate on the script bouncing around in my head. And then it was my turn. I stood and walked to the front of the room, giving the girl from Wyoming a look. She gave me a weak smile and I swallowed. My throat was dry. "This is so embarrassing. What the fuck are you doing here? What are you doing here?" And yet, there was my family, absolutely beaming. "That's our girl," they said silently. "How amazing she is." I announced my competition number, bowed my head, took two shaky breaths in, and started.
"Jesus isn't angry because he brings us love, but there's plenty angry in his place. Praise Jesus!"
A falsetto and sing-songy Southern accent came from my mouth as I looked at the judges in their glassy eyes. They were emotionless.
For the return of all sinners to God. Dear God, I say in my prayer, send the bomb to punish us at last in your mercy, and bless us in the same instant forever and ever. Amen.
That was it. They disqualified me immediately after that first round. I went home to Montana with my family and spent the rest of the summer swimming in glacier-fed lakes and walking aimlessly around my small town until 3, 4, 5 in the morning, reflecting on my successes and failures. I talked with my friends until our voices got hoarse, and I spent every day wondering if we would still be important to each other in 10 years, or whether we'd drift apart. I leapt from the precipice into adulthood. And that was 8 years ago now. Since then, a lot has changed. I moved to Washington, I went to college, worked in AmeriCorps, got a job making this podcast. But that feeling I learned in Las Vegas, that feeling of being an imposter, a baby among adults, a sheep in wolf's clothing, that feeling remains. It's a feeling that lays dormant, sometimes for days or months or years, but it's a feeling that endures. Jeff tells me that my imposter syndrome is actually a good thing. He tells me that the fact that I feel like an imposter means that I'm smart enough to be critical, to be a devil's advocate. He says, "Show me someone that doesn't feel like they're faking it, and I'll show you a narcissist." But I don't buy it, because some days, I still feel like that sweaty, ill-prepared teenager standing in front of a line of judges who may or may not be able to see the tear in the lining of my pink pinstripe suit. And I don't know how long it takes to mend something like that. But I am trying. Real hard. The story was written and produced by me, Bethany Denton. It was edited with help from Jeff Emptman and Nick White, our editor at KCRW. Music from The Black Spot and Flower Petal Downpour. The monologue you heard on this episode is from a play by Joyce Carol Oates called I Stand Before You Naked. I actually still have the original play booklet that I bought in Borders all those years ago. And for this episode, I revived my role of nuclear holocaust for the first time in 8 years. And it will probably be the last time. Our website is hbmpodcast.com. And for this episode, you can find pictures of me at high school speech and debate competitions, including one of me wearing my pink pinstripe suit. Just head to hbmpodcast.com. We are also on Facebook and we tweet at HBM Podcast. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon. Let's try that laugh one more time.